Branches on the trees bend to one side and sway uncontrollably. The high grass against the perimeter fence has all but been flattened as well. As just a few metres away from me, as you can probably hear, the world's most advanced attack military helicopter, the Apache, is preparing to take to the skies above Hampshire. I'm Chris Sturgis, and more about this magnificent machine coming up later. But first, let's about turn and go from the present day back to where it all started. I'm here at Middle Wallop at the Army Aviation Centre, as this year, 2017, sees the 60th anniversary of the Army Air Corps. But soldiers in the air is nothing new. They've been getting airborne since the late 1800s, to be precise. And a brisk walk from the helicopter takeoff site is the Museum of Army Flying, which houses the history of soldiers in the air and the aircraft they used to fly. The curator here is Susan Lindsay.
Well, captive balloons filled with hydrogen were first used in the American Civil War for observation purposes, because obviously there's a great advantage to achieving height. It enables you to see further, to observe the enemy. And that activity was actually witnessed by some Royal Engineers officers. And they went away and undertook some experiments and trials at their own expense, until eventually, in 1878, the War Office officially approved the use of balloons for observation. The advantage of height gave you a great perspective over terrain that you just couldn't get from any other means, and it was very effective. Initially, those balloons were made of fabric, but in time they started making them of an item called gold beater skin, and this was ox intestine that they very carefully stitched together to make a gas bag that actually worked quite effectively.
Many people to this day can't believe that it was the Army flying in the skies above us, long before the blue of the Royal Air Force came along to take centre stage.
The aviation remained within the Royal Engineers from 1878 up until 1912, when they formed the Royal Flying Corps. Now, this unit was comprised of actually several different parts. There was a military wing, a naval wing, a central flying school, and also what later became known as the Royal Aircraft Factory. So during the bulk of the First World War, aviation was undertaken by the Army and the Royal Navy. And it was only when those two branches combined on the 1st of April in 1918 that we get the Royal Air Force. So very much all of those early years, it is very much Army aviation leading the way.
Chris Irons is Secretary of the Army Air Corps, based here at Middle Wallop.
Well, the early flying machines were provided by commercial companies. So the Bristol Box Kite, for example, was used by the RFC back in 1911, 1912. They were generally at the very early stages of flight. Bear in mind that flight development, powered flight development, that is, actually took off very quickly, and excuse the pun on that respect, in as much as we went from aircraft number one, which was literally tubes of steel and bamboo and canvas, to very sophisticated aircraft like the Sopwith Camel and the SE-5A.
And what did those early flights involve?
A good example of an early mission was a private venture by a Royal Artillery officer who took in his head to hire or borrow an aircraft from Bristol Aircraft Company in order to conduct an observation shoot for the Royal Artillery doing manoeuvres on Salisbury Plain. So he took off from Lark Hill and actually flew over and, using telegraphy, communicated with the gun lines and watched the fall of shot and corrected the gunners.
So George White is the great-grandson of the founder of the Bristol Aeroplane Company. The Bristol Scout made its maiden flight from nearby Lark Hill Garrison around 1914. Sir George explains the difficulties his great-grandfather had convincing the government to buy these planes and put them into service.
He tried very hard to get the army interested. You know, everybody knew that war was coming, and he felt it desperately important that we had proper air power. And the government just wouldn't play. They just didn't get the hang of it at all. And on many occasions, you know, when aircraft were demonstrated, they said, oh, the view from an aeroplane flattens out the landscape, so it's useless. For scouting purposes, it's useless. You need a man on a horse. And so what he decided to do, and one of the reasons that he came and opened his flying school and his sheds at Lark Hill, was that he felt that if he set up next to a cavalry camp, as at Lark Hill, then the young men would desperately want to fly. And so instead of persuading the government downwards, he thought he'd start at the men themselves upwards. And of course, that's what happened, and that's what worked. And that's really how we ended up with the Royal Flying Corps.
And for those of you who are familiar with flying, you'll be well aware of filling out your logbook as well. Ever wondered where they originated?
Well, there were logbooks, I believe, available from the end of the 19th century for ballooning. But there were no logbooks available for fixed-wing aircraft because, of course, there weren't any fixed-wing aircraft. But my grandfather always claimed to be an author because he devised and had printed the first logbooks for fixed-wing aircraft, which have wonderful sections that you were supposed to fill in, you know, for forced landings and broken spars and all the, you know, involuntary descents, I think he described them as. And I, by extraordinary good fortune, happened to have the oldest one that is actually filled in, which was given to Henri Jouleroux, who was one of the great French pilots they brought across to fly at Lark Hill. And Jouleroux filled in, the first page was a flight in June 1911, which he flew from Filton at Bristol down to Lark Hill. And he describes wonderfully how he descended. He did a vol plané, which was the great showy way of landing, from 2,500 feet. Above the Fargate plantation and ended in front of the sheds where we're standing at this moment.
So with those early days of air flight at Lark Hill behind us, the Army Air Corps was now coming into its own.
So if you imagine when it started in 1957, it took under its wing those pilots of the Air Observation Post squadrons and the Glider Pilot Regiment. And they literally carried on similar duties to they'd been doing before. That's to say, observing for the guns, light liaison flying and reconnaissance flights. The development of rotary wing aircraft and the experience of Korea, for example, in the 1950s, showed the Army that they needed to get into an environment using rotary aircraft in more than just the role of reconnaissance and observation. So if you look also into the Vietnam War, where the Americans quite rightly used a mixture of armed and transport aircraft to protect their troops and deliver them into battle, we started looking at that, and I think a really good example of that is Operation Musketeer in 1956, which was Suez, and that was the first use of support helicopters and small helicopters in the observation world.
So, to those early days, it's now the tail end of the 1950s.
Although the Army Air Corps is officially only 2 years old, the Blue Beret is rapidly becoming as distinguished a symbol of crack efficiency as the famous Red Beret and Green Beret before them. The versatility of helicopters has to be seen to be believed.
Ross Malloch, together with John Grandy, came from the Tank Regiment and the QDG, respectively.
I followed my father into the 5th Royal Tank Regiment in 1960. Enjoyed myself in Germany for a year or two, but then found that there was probably more to life than lying in a pool of oil under a Centurion tank all day. And I happened to see a notice on the squadron wall, are you interested in flying? And I thought, well, I'd never thought of that before, but I might give it a go. And so I found myself here at Middle Wallop in 1964 on the flying course and qualified in May 1965 and found myself back in Germany, to my great dismay, but flying Skeeter helicopters instead of lying flat underneath a blasted tank. And that completely gave me a totally new slant on life in Germany. We had three Skeeters in the bottom of the tank park, and every armoured regiment, every infantry battalion had its own little flight of three. And it was a wonderful scheme dreamt up by the Army Air Corps to increase the number of pilots, because the idea was that by integrating it with the units, you could actually increase the fleet. And it did. And we had the most wonderful time. And I wouldn't have changed it for anything. I stayed in the Royal Tank Regiment, although I was flying, until the 5th Tanks were disbanded in 1969. I then transferred to the Army Air Corps. And I then trained as an instructor. And it was during that time that I got involved in the display flying scene.
John Grandy's introduction to the Army Air Corps came a few years later. So why did he go for helicopters?
Right, well, my career was much shorter and much less distinguished than Ross's. I joined the Army in 1966 and was commissioned into the Queen's Green Guards, and I served with them in Aden and Germany before going on the flying course in 1969. I was then posted to the 3rd Carbineers Air Squadron, as Ross says, the regiments had their own air squadrons and air troops in those days, and that was tremendous fun. And I served with them in Germany, back to Germany, and in Northern Ireland. And then I went off and did the instructor's course with the Royal Air Force at Turnhill, Central Flying School, and I came back to Middle Wallop as an instructor and started then getting on the sort of display scene with the 1972 team, which I flew in with a view to becoming the leader of the Blue Eagles in 1973. For a chap like me, really, that was the pinnacle.
Ross Malick has fond memories of the Skeeter. He was flying them in the 60s.
It was really like being a teenager in a go-kart for the first time. It was hideously underpowered, but enormously manoeuvrable. So you could do almost anything with it, provided you can get it off the ground. A certain amount of ingenuity was required to actually take off in the thing very often, particularly on a hot day. But once you were airborne and you stayed airborne, it was just wall-to-wall fun.
In fact, it takes about a year to train a helicopter pilot from scratch and costs in the region of £3,000.
Ross and John were both members of the Blue Eagles aerobatic display team. How did that come about?
The team was the dream of a wonderfully eccentric Army aviator called Major Mike Somerton Rayner, who was instructing here at Wallop as on Sioux. He was in charge of all the Sioux flying here, where the instructors were there to teach ab initio students how to fly their operational aircraft. And I was working for him, and one day he said, "Do you want to go to Cyprus for 6 months?" I didn't actually answer because I was gone, I was away. And I had a lovely time at Cyprus, and he got in touch with me and said, "When you come back, I'm thinking of forming a display team of 5 Sioux here. Are you interested?" I had no idea what I was letting myself in for, but it seemed a good wheeze. And so when I got home, back to Wallop, he and 4 of us got together and we worked out a sort of routine, trying it out on a suck it and see basis.
But the Blue Eagles had a nemesis.
We found ourselves on a mountain flying trip up in RAF Valley at Anglesey. We were flying from Valley to the Snowdon Hills, where we were doing mountain flying training for the students. And our morning trip out to the Snowdonia was held up by the arrival of the Red Arrows, who'd been flying, I think, for about 2 years by then. I think they started in 66. And their arrival stopped everything, and we couldn't start work, and we got very cross sitting there in our helicopters, the engines running, being unable to move, because they were messing around with all this smoke and all this sort of stuff, you know, and hygiene manoeuvres and all this rubbish. And anyway, when we finally were allowed to leave, one of the wags in the formation simply gave an order to the Red Rissoles, as it was. And we were so taken by this that we became known internally as the Rissoles, really, and we flew very successfully as Red Rissoles because we'd never actually thought of having an official title. And unfortunately, the gaff was blown by Raymond Baxter at Biggin Hill at the Battle of Britain display, and we found ourselves on BBC television. There was only one television channel in those days. And when we came home, we watched it with bated breath, and sure enough, he blew the gaff on us and said, "And these hardy Army helicopter pilots are known collectively as the Rissoles." And this caused the most terrible problem with the chain of command here at Wallop, and we were told to buck up and get ourselves organised, and we were then called the Blue Eagles, and it was forced on us, and it was fine. We didn't mind.
And it wasn't long before the camaraderie between these two was put to the test as skullduggery set in.
We became actually very friendly with them, and I know John Grandy's team flew with them. In fact, I think almost all the teams flew with the Red Arrows, and we had mutual trips together. We did get our own back on them at Biggin Hill when the gaff had been blown about our Rissoles, because they sprayed the Red Arrows logo on all of our aircraft and all of our helicopters on the fin overnight. And we found, when we came to do our pre-flight inspection for the display the following morning, we all had Red Arrows painted all over our aeroplanes. We were very upset about this. So I went away and bought a fish cake, which is about as close as I could get locally to a Rissole. And there was one fish cake was put on the seat of every Nat, which I hope was eventually sat on by the occupant.
Well, we continued the relationship with the Red Arrows, and we did a lot of displays with them. There was one famous occasion when we were all doing a display at a very small airfield in Germany called Auf den Dumpel, where the Red Arrows couldn't land. So we went back to Cologne, I think it was, and picked them all up to come back to the party at Auf den Dumpel, huge sort of beer-swilling German-type party. And we were flying back. The weather wasn't brilliant, and I suddenly thought to myself, God, I've got all the Red Arrows pilots on board on our formation. We better make sure we get A, we don't get lost, and B, we don't run out of fuel, and C, we get to the right place on time. But they loved it. And then we went off and did some single aircraft flying, aerobatics and stuff with them. And at the end of the day, I'd had all our aircraft fitted up with dual controls, and we invited them to try out their skills at hovering. So there was a little bit of mutual admiration, I think, by the end of the day. And I think that year we did 75 displays, far away as Inverness, two trips to Germany, I think, the Paris Air Show, and everything in between. So one spent one's weekends away, chugging around at 65 knots, and preparing smoke bombs. That was the other thing you had to do. We had hundreds and hundreds of smoke bombs, which had to be specially prepared so they could be fired electrically from the... because that was a very important part of the display, to give it a bit of impact.
Before passing out, in the service sense, a helicopter pilot has to have at least 90 hours flying under his belt. But whether they're tackling a serious operation or light-hearted displays like these, it's true to say the Blue Beret Army Air Corps of today are flying high.
From here onwards, technology really came into its own.
Then we got the Scout, which could be used as a light utility aircraft, and then we fitted missiles to it as well. So now we enter into the combat area, and we become a combat arm with the ability to strike at the enemy using our missiles. The next development of that was the Lynx, and the development of the TOW missile system, which is basically optically wire-guided missile. And that was used extensively in BAOR as part of the divisional aviation units for the Cold War. And of course then we all know that along came the Apache, and that really showed its worth when it was deployed in Afghanistan on Operation Herrick. So in terms of equipment highlights, those are certainly the ones that you would pick out and say that's part of the evolutionary process.
And other significant milestones have been reached as well.
We were probably the first to have women aviators in a combat role. And I think we've also quite proudly pointed to the fact that we've had women in roles on the ground as well for a long time. And when you think that a soldier can join the Army Air Corps as an air trooper, do his ground training, probably become an air gunner, door gunner, and can go on to be a pilot and then commission into the Army Air Corps as well. That's quite a way of developing a career path, and we see that so often in the Corps.
More recently, the Army Air Corps has seen active service around the world, playing a part in many conflicts. Colonel Richard Green is Corps Colonel for the Army Air Corps.
As soon as we armed our helicopters with the Scout and then through the Lynx TOW, particularly in the British Army of the Rhine, where we endured with divisional aviation regiments for a couple of decades, we were a vital part of the direct fire capabilities for 1 BR Corps. And then, of course, the revolution, when we got the Apache 10 years ago or so, enabled us to be equipped and to survive on the battlefield with a very capable, the most capable attack helicopter in the world, which for the Army is a battle-winning equipment.
So who fits the beret? What's the calibre of person he's after?
Well, I do the selection for the Army Air Corps, both for the soldiers and for the officers. And what we're looking for is a high-grade soldier, an NCO, non-commissioned officer, or an officer from Sandhurst, who primarily wants to be an Army officer or a soldier, so they want to be in the land environment. We need high-calibre people who also understand the third dimension, so they want to fly and deliver that manoeuvrability and strike capability for the Army. So high-quality people who have an aptitude and an inkling to go flying.
And how does he feel when the Corps is referred to as the cavalry?
Well, if you think about that literally, the cavalry on the battlefield of Waterloo were the arm that could manoeuvre around very quickly around the battlefield to face a threat that the infantry couldn't get to. So it's all about manoeuvre. And of course, we're the most manoeuvrable arm on the battlefield. We can get very quickly across the ground where even, you know, quite quick armoured vehicles can't get to. So if you want firepower or a screen or a strike tens of miles away very, very quickly, we can deliver that, and we can see that far as well. So do we ride around on horses? No. Are we literally the cavalry in the modern context? Yeah, absolutely. we've got some of the best equipment, the best people, and one of the most exciting roles in the Army, and I would say in the forces. So if you just want to go and drive an aircraft around the sky, fine, join the Royal Air Force. If you want to be an Army NCO or an officer and operate one of the manoeuvre platforms, fire manoeuvre ISTAR platforms in the third dimension of the land battlefield, then join the Army Air Corps, because you are making a massive difference to the brigade or the divisional fighting effort, but you're doing it in an aircraft. And if you're driving in an Apache, you've got the most potent direct fire platform on the battlefield. If you're doing it in a Wildcat, you've got the best ISTAR observation aid on the battlefield as well. So we're well equipped, but you're doing it in that extra dimension, which is unique and very, very exciting and attainable for the majority of people. So have a go.
So to the modern day Army Air Corps, and to those whose job involves flying and looking after the Wildcat and the Apache, Lieutenant Andy Jilks is in charge of helicopter training here at Middle Wallop.
From my perspective, it's just about managing and leading teams of experts and making sure that we coordinate all of our activity towards a common goal. And that common goal is making sure that the pilots, when they get to the front line in their Apache on operations, are ready and fully capable to cope with the demands of conflict.
It's a question that often gets asked. How does Andy know when he's got the right person for the job?
That's a really good question, and it's a lot harder to answer than you might think, because every pilot is different. But I think the common trait that we look for is determination, because if they're determined to succeed and they pass the basic medical standards and they can demonstrate the basic aptitude, then the team here at Middle Wallop is experienced and good enough to make a decent and a competent frontline aviator out of anybody.
And on the subject of the Apache, what is it that draws him to this aircraft?
I mean, from my perspective, what makes it awesome is that it's designed entirely around the pilots that are sitting in it. It's a really complicated platform. It's got lots of weapon systems. It's got lots of radars on it. But at the heart of it is helping the pilot fuse all of that technology and all of that information and give him the information, the right bit of information at exactly the right time that he needs it. And on top of that, it's designed to protect the pilot. So everything from nitrogen in the tyres to stroking seats to protect him to an armoured shell around his cockpit. Whenever he goes into conflict, he's getting the right information at the right time, and he's got the confidence that he's being protected by a really able aircraft.
And the big question, the one that's asked most, how long before a person can fly one of these?
So from the moment of passing your basic training, whether it's as an officer or making the required rank as a junior NCO, the basic pilot's course takes about 2 years before you get into an Apache. Once you're in the cockpit of an Apache, you've got about another year and a half's training until I'd be 100% confident about pushing you out of the door on operations.
It's personnel from the REMI whose job it is to maintain these aircraft. Wherever they go, the engineers are right there with them, fixing and ensuring that they're airworthy. Here's ASM Craig Hadley.
It is a varied role. We maintain all of the Army's aircraft, Apache being one of them, and also Lynx, Gazelle, Wildcat. Depending on the size of the deployment, we'll take, obviously, an amount of people. We work 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, obviously in Afghanistan, places like that, to keep the aircraft flying. Technicians at all levels, engineers at all levels, will have that final tick in the box to say that that aircraft is airworthy to go flying, even from Lance Corporal doing the daily flight servicings, checking the oils, doing the levels. They have that responsibility from quite a low level.
Time to take another short walk now past the massive hangars that are home to the Apache helicopter and down to a building that looks very much like an office block. This is ATL, Aviation Training International Limited, and this is where personnel come to train and get evaluated on many aspects of flying an Apache without actually getting into and physically flying one. Paul Stanton is the training centre manager here.
Aviation Training International is a company that is charged with training all those people involved with the Apache force, be they ground crew, air crew, or maintainers. Here at Middle Wallop, we take air crew, ab initio pilots who've just got their wings, and second tourists, and we train them and convert them onto Apache in about an 8-month course. We also take phase three soldiers on ground crew, training on ground crew basic and ground crew advanced, and also train soldiers on planning Apache missions as well as the air crew. At our site in Wadisham, in the Field Army, we have field deployal simulators and also a maintenance training school where all the REMI engineers are trained.
The
building contains simulators and other kit aimed at developing aircrew and getting them up to speed on the complexities of this aircraft. Now, we've been given special access to one of the simulator training exercises. Lots of screens in front of me here, and through the glass, a large white bubble-type object. That's the Apache simulator. And one of the pilots is currently being put through his paces. We'll have a chat with him in a moment, but first, let's listen in to the exchange that's going on between him and the controller sitting next to me.
Continuous single engine failure card, E10.
Mayday, 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 salty ops, this is Panther 80, mayday, we've got an engine failure at low level, requesting a direct track to Netherhaven for an emergency recovery.
Panther 80, Roger, your mayday is acknowledged. Turn left, heading 060.
Left under 060 for Panther 80. I can only set the low height warner to 100 feet. 300 feet set. Holds within. No signs of fire at the moment.
The simulator is vital to all pilots, particularly helicopter pilots in the military. It enables us to do a range of emergencies which we simply couldn't practice for real in the real aircraft, either because the aircraft would be destroyed or because the chances of survival in some of them initially when you first practice it are quite slim. With practice and with realistic scenarios, and as you've seen with the very advanced graphics and the way it emulates the aircraft, perhaps the most important thing, a video game will give you something that's like an aircraft, but it isn't matched. This simulator flies exactly the same as the real aircraft. Consequently, when the emergencies are introduced, even quite severe ones, the aircraft will stop flying normally and will start to effectively limp along. And that gives us a chance to practice that. And that's critical. It's a bit like the golf club analogy we like to use. In most normal flying, you're using a 7-iron. It's pretty straightforward. When you're flying in the simulator, you get to use a lot of the clubs and a lot of the techniques that you never see. A pilot may hopefully never, ever see the aircraft in the configurations that it's put in the simulator. But because they've been in that situation before, if it does by a 1 in 100,000 plus chance happen to them, they know what to do and they've been there before. And that familiarity lessens the shock of being in the emergency situation, helps them keep going with their training, and helps them get the aircraft back on the ground. Ultimately, that's the safe aim of any simulator.
I just go through.
This is an ongoing thing. You're continually assessed. You don't just come here once, then that's it.
Oh, no, not at all. You know, there's an old adage about the day you stop learning is the day you should stop flying. I've been flying for nearly 30 years. I come in the simulator probably every month. There's a mandatory requirement. We do 3 hours every 6 months. We look at a range of emergencies. Some we do all the time because they're more common. Some are less common. So we practice them every sort of 5 or 6 months. But it goes on forever. It's a never-ending, cross-country steeplechase around your career when you're a pilot. You know, you're never off duty.
Of course, we know that the Apache is an attack helicopter. So when you're in there in the simulator, do you get weapons training as well? How does it work like that?
Well, absolutely. The Apache is a weapon. Unlike other helicopters we had, it's primary. One of the things we first encouraged the students to think of it as a weapon itself. And consequently, as the course rolls on, particularly in the second half of the course, it's all about the weapons because that's what it does for the Army. It fulfills that function. The cost of munitions is very high. The range of the weapons on the Apache is huge, you know, tens of kilometres rather than hundreds of metres. So consequently, with Britain being a fairly crowded island, it's difficult to find ranges that are big enough. Only really Otterburn and some of the coastal ranges are big enough for us to fire. We do go to America and we've tried Germany and Poland. Very expensive endeavours, I'm sure you'd agree. So what we tend to use is the simulator where the cost of munitions is effectively zero. They're just generated computer-generated missiles. And we do most of our training there. They fire many, many missiles and many thousands of 30mm simulated rounds before they ever fire a live one.
I'm going to go around, climb runway track 2,000 feet and then recontact this frequency.
So you could take yourself via the simulator into a conflict situation?
Absolutely. And towards the latter end of their training, they do quite involved missions against very difficult enemies with electronic, radar, all sorts of threats against them, and really do test them. And they will often spend 2 hours getting in position just to fire a single missile and fail. And that's what the simulator's for. So they then learn to overcome those problems and get to the point where they will succeed.
230, final approach.
A soldier, whatever cap badge, could become a pilot of an Apache. Is that right?
Absolutely right. Yeah, I joined the army in 1980 something as a private soldier in the infantry. Started flying after 6 years, became a corporal, then became a sergeant, and then all the way up and finished as one. I'm a major now. So, yeah, absolutely.
So we've gone from balloons and reconnaissance missions in the 1800s through the years and world conflicts to the present day. And we finish where we started, with the Apache, the world's most advanced military helicopter and arguably the Army Air Corps' most prized possession. I've been given exclusive access to one of them, and who better to give me a guided tour of this most awesome machine than one of the Apache's pilots.
The aircraft primarily was built for pilots. It was built post-Vietnam era, so it was designed, although designed in 1964, it's a very different beast from its original platform. And now, stood in front of you, is our £44 million attack helicopter. Day-night capable, all-weather capable, with a radar. It does exactly what it says on the tin. It's an attack helicopter.
£44 million this machine cost. Do you ever think about that when you're actually flying it?
Never. I don't, because you don't jump in your car every day and think, no, if I crash this, it's going to cost me 20 grand. Exactly the same as this.
This must be the best job in the world, doing this, being a pilot of one of these, surely.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. And the real joy of this helicopter is that it was built for the pilot from the ground up. So it's comfortable, it's got air conditioning, it's got rockets, and it's got cannon to boot. So what's not to like?
Don't argue with it. During operations, more recently Afghanistan, what a support this has been for the infantry on the ground.
Yeah, it totally changed the face of the Army Air Corps, literally overnight, due to the capabilities. And, you know, I've got to take my hat off not only to Boeing, but also to Westlands that have put this together to make the most reliable, the most survivable, and the most fearsome attack platform on the planet.
When people see these Apaches approaching, they kind of say, here come the cavalry, we're going to be okay now. You guys coming in, it does send a shiver down your spine at times. You've got to be honest.
Well, obviously, we just do the best job we can for the guy on the ground. That's all I was ever interested in, was the infantier. I wanted to make this aircraft a sort of angel on his wing, if you like. Just another tool in his toolbox that he can use to deliver effect.
What is this on the top of the Apache, this cylindrical bubble-like object? What have we got here?
That's the fire control radar. So that's the radar that hunts and tracks our ground targets, whether it be tanks or APUs. Because don't forget, this aircraft, although we used it in Afghanistan, we're now using it in contingency operations, and it's ready to deploy anywhere in the world.
Okay, let's just continue our walk around. These look pretty tasty. What we've got on the side here, what's this?
These are the rocket pods, 19 rockets in each pod. We can have 4 pods fitted to the aircraft, so a total of 76 rockets. It's not one type of rocket. We can have many different types within the one pod. And we can fire them as individual rockets or as pairs. We can fire 12 at a time or all of them if you want.
And this is a unique shape, isn't it? I've never seen anything like this shape that the Apache is.
Yeah, it wasn't built, I don't think, in a wind tunnel. It wasn't built with the raw aerodynamics in mind, or as a fuel-saving measure. Everything on the aircraft is for a reason. We have fitted, for instance, the Rolls-Royce engines. We fitted our own helicopter integrated defensive aid suite that protects us from the incoming fire as well.
Everything about the Apache, everything about this machine says, don't mess with me.
Yeah, it does. But not only is it built to deliver a punch, it's also built to take a punch. So think of it more as a flying tank, if you like.
And when you're up there flying this, what's that like for you?
It's the best job in the world. I don't know why more people don't apply. I joined the army as a private soldier. no education, very few qualifications, O-levels, GCSEs, and now I'm flying this, because the Army are absolutely great, aren't they, at giving everyone an opportunity, and all you've got to do is apply and go for it, make it through the course, and the Army will do the rest.
This year, 2017, the 60th anniversary of the Army Air Corps, is an occasion that will be commemorated in a very special way. Chris Irons, Secretary of the Army Air Corps, once more.
One of the great things that we're doing this year is receiving our new guidon, and one of the things we received when we became a combat arm was a guidon, which would say we have a standard or a colour, which is what people would know it as. Our original one was presented to us in 1994 by our Colonel-in-Chief at that time, Prince of Wales. It will be retired this year. It'll be laid up in Salisbury Cathedral, and we'll have a new one, a replacement guidon.
So, happy anniversary, Army Air Corps, and here's to your next 60 years. I'm Chris Sturgis at the Army Aviation Centre, Middle Wallop, for Forces Radio, BFBS.